Members, I'm going to call this meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so it's not officially underway, but I thank those members who are here at this time. All right? I truly do appreciate it. Could go off on a tirade on the level of importance to... anyway.
Actually, that's...
Is this clock a little fast?
Yes, it is.
All right. You know, my students tried to pull the same one on. We started this whole committee process this year in taking a big picture look at education in the state of Minnesota. Our very first meeting was set to look at this, how the system called public education in the state of Minnesota was serving the children and the families and the society that we have today. Right? And as we saw, there are some good things that are happening within the system for kids, but there are also some areas of concern. And I think that's real important for us as a policy committee, is to take the time to look at those things and to think about the system we have. I think, you know, some people have raised concern with the name of the committee and the name change, that it was changed from education policy to education policy and reform. But when you really think about those words, right, education policy and reform, it's almost to me redundant, right, because everything we do within this committee, every piece of legislation that we pass is in policy is really reforming in some way, shape, or form the system of education. It just, you know, and it can happen in big steps, it can happen in little steps, but the very fact that we make policy decisions and policy changes necessitates a reforming of the system itself. So, I think that is always been a mandate of the policy committee, is to look at the system that we have, right, and how it is working for the children it is meant to serve, and then how it can be changed. Today we're going to take that conversation up to the 10,000 foot level, right, and to think deeply about this whole system that that we have created. And I say that very specifically, that we have created, right, because it is the legislature that has created this system, and to look at it and to think about how it is developed, how it is serving our kids, right, and what is our responsibility as policymakers and as legislators in helping the system truly serve the best that we can. Sometimes if the system isn't working, we look at the components within the system and say, now fix it. Right? And that really is almost an abdication of our responsibility as policymakers to make those decisions. So today, as we listen and as we have our hopefully conversation with our invited guests, I challenge you to not only think about the system, right, but then think about the actions that we can take, right, in helping the system, again, best serve the people that are within it. And not only the students who are being served by the system, but also by the adults who are working very, very hard to the best of their abilities within the system, what is our obligation as policymakers to continue to help the system evolve so that they can do the best job possible also. So, welcome. At this time, we do have a quorum, so I would officially call this meeting to order. And before we do anything else, I have been duly chastised by our CLA for forgetting to ask for approval of the minutes at our last meeting. All right. So in your packets, members, are two sets of minutes. And the first one being the minutes from January 20th. Do I have a motion to approve?
So move to approve.
Representative Marquardt moves to approve the minutes. Any discussions or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. We also have in our packets the minutes from the January 25th. Meeting.
I would move those minutes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Severson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion is approved. Thank you. Members, today we are honored to have with us at least two. Do we see our third? Okay. We are honored to have with us some people who have spent time, all right, up in the 10,000-foot level thinking about the system that we have, and also have spent time actually coming down to the ground, right, in creating policies and ideas in helping the system evolve and in helping best serve the kids that we have. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce to the committee Mr. Joe Graba and Mr. Dan Loritz. And if I were to list their accolades, I would probably fall well short, so I'll let them give a little bio for the committee, introduce themselves, but I welcome them to the committee at this time. Mr. Graba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. This is always sort of nostalgic for me. I sat on your side of the table for about 6 years. Don't mind. I don't know whether we can get by with this, but I can't see something.
We put that down.
Maybe that was intentional. I guess I wouldn't blame you. I tell folks that I served in the territorial legislature back. It seems that long ago, but it was back during the 70s, and in fact, one of my roommates was Representative Eakin's father, so we have a long history together. I want to start this out by kind of setting the framework. Actually, we had thought Ember Reichgott Young was going to join us this morning, and she may still, folks. Ember was deeply involved in helping create some of the choice legislation back in the end of the 80s and early 90s. Dan Loritz was also deeply involved in that, and if Ember doesn't show, Dan has agreed to cover those areas for us. But let me just quickly say that I think a lot of folks think we're wrestling with an education system that has deteriorated over the last quarter century. And I want to tell you that I don't think that's an accurate picture. I want to tell you that I think we have had a constantly escalating set of expectations for public education in our country. And driven, I believe, largely by the growing importance of knowledge in our society. And I think, this is just my mental picture, but if you could graph it, my sense is that all through the 20th century, the importance of knowledge continued to escalate. And as that happened, we continued to have elevated expectations for our schools. And somewhere in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, I believe knowledge quietly became the key strategic resource in our society. Now, at one time in our history, land was the key strategic resource when we were an agricultural economy. And then later we became an industrial economy, and natural resources and plant capacity became the key strategic resources. Sometime in my mind, at least, that curve ticked upward as knowledge became the key strategic resource. I was Deputy Commissioner of Education in the last part of the 1970s, and we began to get input from our business leaders. I really believe the business leaders in this country were the first ones to begin to elevate their concerns about our education system. And they began to realize that the future of their organizations, the future of their companies, was dependent on the knowledge level of their employees. And as that happened, they began to express concerns to our political leaders around the country about the quality of public education in this country. That led, I believe, to the political leaders and the business leaders beginning to ratchet up the expectations for the system. We had a surge in the late 70s and 80s of people wanting to be the education governors. Jim Hunt of North Carolina, in his first cycle as governor, was probably one of the first. Lamar Alexander in Tennessee was another example. Rudy Perpich, who Dan worked for in the 80s, wanted Minnesota to be the brain power state. There was increasing pressure to escalate the amount of learning occurring in our educational enterprises. And I believe that's what led to the kind of escalated pressure that we see today on our public education system. And I'll have more to say about that, but I'd like to, at this point, hand it over to Dan, because Dan worked on these issues from a variety of positions during those years.
Thanks, Joe. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dan Loritz, currently at Hamline University, where I'm the Vice President of University Relations and the lead faculty in our graduate school on education and public policy, which I have been since. I've been hiding out over there since the 90 election. So when Rudy Perpich lost the election in 90, we were all cast to the wind. I want to give you a little background about myself and then kind of bring you up, I think, to where Rudy Perpich had his idea that was called access to excellence, and how did we get to that. And I'll try to do that pretty quickly so we can have a conversation, but just some background. I'm a teacher from Moundsview, taught in Moundsview. I taught both at the high school and elementary level. The elementary level was frightening. High school was not frightening. I ended up in the Department of Education in 1972.
Mr. Lawrence, was that frightening for the kids or you?
I think it was, I felt like the kindergarten cop, you know. I joined the Air Force to see the world. They sent me to Texas, and when I came out, you know, I was kind of trying to figure out what to do, and I ended up teaching, and I loved it, as a matter of fact, and ended up in the Department of Education in 1972. I actually appeared, my first legislative committee was before Joe Graber's committee in 1973, and we were trying to figure out what this teacher from Wadena really knew about school finance. I mean, that was really the kind of issue. But I come from the east side of St. Paul. How I got hooked up with Rudy Perpich is he told me that the east side of St. Paul at the time that I was raised there and the Iron Range were pretty much the same. I'm a labor guy from the east side of St. Paul. And so when the governor asked me to go to work for him, it was really, given his interest in education, it was quite an opportunity for me, and I really jumped at it. He asked me 2 days later why I did it, and I said, well, I mean, what a great opportunity. This is really my interest. He says, well, don't get to like it here. You can't stay. He said, this is just a temporary job. You know, I'll get defeated one day, or I'll decide not to run. And so what are you going to do when you're not doing this anymore? So, I mean, that was kind of a sobering thought. But we had a lot to do during that period. Let me just kind of couch this in the, for those of you who are historians, you may know when the 30 Years' War was. Anybody know when the 30 Years' War was? That's okay. Nobody does. But it ran from 1618 to 1648. And the thing about it is that nobody woke up in 1642 and said, if we could just get through the next 6 years, we would be out of the 30 Years' War. Nobody knew it was the 30 Years' War. And the lesson in that is that we are always in a time that has no name. And we are in a time now that has no name. And we don't know all of the dynamics, and we don't know how long it will last, whatever this period is. And yet we have to make decisions in this time, not knowing where we're at, or what in the future people will look back on and say, well, history was named at this. And so I think Joe and I are getting far enough along, we can kind of look back now and start to get a better idea. So, you know, my sense is here to kind of to give a little history about this. When I entered the Department of Education in 1972, there were three things that were big discussions. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, the Higher Education Act of 1965, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. These were, in the words of the people in the Department of Education, the first time this country got serious about educating everybody. This is the first time in the history of the country that there was a pronouncement at the federal level that said we need to make an investment, Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 65, which was where Title I came from, Title II, Title III, Title IV, Title V. So all of that came about. The Higher Education Act, which is where the loans, federal loans, all of those things came. And the reason for the emphasis was that everybody could vote now. And if everybody could vote now, then everybody needed to be educated. So that was really what was there. And in fact, in the 73 session, the Department of Education brought in some essential learner outcomes and a statewide assessment program. You know, standards and testing was what was there. But in 1974, you know, Minnesota became the first state in the union to allow a tax deduction for tuition to private schools. Went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme or U.S. Supreme Court, Mueller versus Allen. So there was this sense, as you look back on it, about this idea of something called access to excellence. That was the way that was viewed. But if you kind of roll this forward, you know, I think we've had four governors during this period from 1970 that I would say until about 1988. So we've got Governor Wendell Anderson, Governor Rudy Perpich twice, Governor Arne Carlson, and Governor Al Quie. So two Republican governors, two Democratic governors, all of them basically the same in their thought about education. So if you take Wendell Anderson, he was interested in access to excellence, which was the Minnesota Miracle, which was a way for small schools to finally get some money, so or low property value schools, so they could do that. That access was tied to standards, so we had that. We had access to private schools. That was there. As Rudy Perpich came in for his second term, he really worked the state grant program, just to throw in a higher ed piece of this. He basically said that the tuition at the public universities had to go to one-third. And if he would have been reelected in 90, it would have gone, he would have brought in a proposal to go to two-thirds. So the idea of heavy tuition and heavy state grant program has been around, you know, a very long time, if we kind of think back on that. If you take the issue then about what was happening, the economy was not very good. We came out of the kind of 78 to 82 period, six special legislative sessions. There really wasn't much money. Governor Quie, during that period, his access to excellence was K-3. He was interested in early childhood education, just really didn't have any money. So we came into the 85 session with a Republican House, now with the Department of Education again, and a Democratic Senate. So not much different 20 years ago than it is right now. So this is the way the situation was in 1985. We were also faced with a $1 billion income tax cut. Ronald Reagan had pushed through changes in the federal taxes at the national level, and Minnesota had to conform. The state budget was $13 billion for the biennium, and we had to get rid of $1 billion. Think about that. So when I think about your $700 million or $1.4 billion against $30 billion, it wasn't as much of a task as the task that that we had. But Rudy Perfect said to us, he said, there isn't any money. So what are we going to do? And so the discussion was, so what have we done? And there were two things that were themes that ran all the way through the 70s and early 80s, which was standards and assessment and access. That was the two things. And it was Rudy Perfect's press secretary, Jerry Nelson, who actually came up with the idea of calling it access to excellence. He said, I think that's what we're after here, access in higher education, access in K-12. So into the 1985 session came Rudy's 8 points of access to excellence, which was for 11th and 12th graders to access colleges and universities. And I just want to side on this, is that one other access to excellence in 83 was the creation of the state vocational system, of which Joe was the first director. And it was used to be part of the Department of Education, part of local school districts, and Rudy wanted a system that basically had a technical component, a community college component, the state universities and the major research university, and the private universities. And I didn't want to kind of go by that, because that was kind of that was a huge access to excellence issue, was the creation of the technical system, which I would kind of save my opinions about that for another day. But kind of, I think we're losing that. So losing that aspect of it, which is very important. But anyway, Rudy had this post-secondary enrollment options, which means you could go to the technical colleges, or you could go to the community colleges, or you could go to private colleges, or you could go to the University of Minnesota. There was open enrollment, K-12 open enrollment, enrollment options program. Rudy also brought in learner outcomes. He brought in testing in grades 3, 5, and 8. Now, the learner outcomes didn't go, and the testing didn't go. He also brought in access to state's high schools, the state arts high school, which did go. But he brought in a state math and science school, which didn't go. He brought in a staff development fund, figuring that teachers who are going to have to face a more competitive environment would need more staff development. He brought in the takeover of the basic mill levy was part of Access to Excellence, which actually didn't happen until a few years ago. But the buyout of the basic mill levy was part of Access to Excellence, that the state would step up, take a larger responsibility for funding, take a larger responsibility in setting standards and assessment, and then provide more options, more opportunities. So that was the framework of it. State pays more, state sets the standards. He who has the gold sets the standards and sets the assessment and then provides options. So the first charter that was granted was to the post-secondary systems to take 11th and 12th grade students. When you think about that, that was a charter. They were given a charter to educate 11th and 12th grade students if they so chose. That was the only part of that piece that really passed that session, and it passed because of the House of Representatives, which was Republican, and Connie Levi, who was the majority leader at the time, was instrumental in getting that passed. The 86 session was a protection of that. The 87 session was voluntary open enrollment, meaning that you didn't have to participate. Rudy wrote letters to about 167 school districts and said, are you afraid to compete? And 80 of them said no. And so the voluntary piece started. Actually, of the ones who wanted to do it, it was mostly the small schools. Almost all the small schools were the ones who kind of stepped up and said, sure, we can compete. We can compete with anybody. So then in the 88 session, Amber's not here, but Amber...
Mr. Lord?
Amber,
she did meet.
Come on. You're here. Come leave us here. So, Amber carried the bill, which she'll talk about in a minute, that brought open enrollment to its full implementation, which then was occurred over the next couple of years.
Good to see you.
The other pieces of open enrollment at the time, or the other pieces of access to excellence, was that the charter school idea was brought in 89 and 90, didn't pass until 91, which Ember will pick up. But I think I'll stop at the point of there was this sense that this access to excellence idea was
running through the 70s, clearly, kind of pushed forward by the issue in terms of programs that were passed in 1965. It was given fuel by the Nation at Risk report in 83, which really kind of fueled the whole matter of how are we going to do this. So the balance of the 80s was quite interesting. That did, I'll just say, spill over into Governor Carlson's administration, where he followed three parts. He worked on the standards. The first testing, the one that was proposed in Access to Excellence, was finally passed in 97. A tuition tax credit, which was also offered in 74 but didn't pass, was finally passed in 97. So if I think I was to characterize Governor Carlson's education issues, again, it was standards, assessment, options. So I think I'll stop there.
Senator Rae Scott Young, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. It's a true privilege, and I appreciate the invitation. I am beginning my fifth year of retirement from the Minnesota Senate, and I just want to, I acknowledge you for your public service. I really do. And I can just tell you it's the greatest gift that you've ever been given. And I can tell you one thing, that in retirement, the gift continues. And this, Mr. Chairman, is a true gift, and I thank you for this privilege. My hope today is to continue the story that Dan started on just this whole involvement, my observations about the creation of public school choice in Minnesota, and that we can learn from it and build on it for the future. I am going to pick up right where you left off on post-secondary options. Connie Levi was indeed the visionary on that. And then we had voluntary open enrollment, and then no one really thought that mandatory open enrollment would occur in this state. I should probably, Mr. Chairman, I forgive me, it's been 4 years, but I didn't identify myself for the record, did I? No. I'll try that. My goodness. Amber Rice got young.
Yeah.
My two representatives are sitting here watching me, and I think I'm just really nervous about that. I am Amber Reichstadt Young. My affiliation, for the record, is I am a lawyer with the General Counsel Limited. I do business law, and I also work with nonprofits. I am on the board of directors of the Charter School Leadership Council out of Washington, D.C., and I am host of two new radio shows called Women on the Move. Back to 1987, 88, there had been a lot of discussion about voluntary open enrollment, but a lot of people don't realize how open enrollment actually started. The Minnesota Business Partnership had developed a bill on statewide testing, and that also included as another article this whole notion of open enrollment. In one of those lessons to be learned from legislative history, the line to my office was almost exclusively about statewide testing as far as the issues and the concerns. But no one talked about open enrollment. And so it appeared to me that there hadn't been a lot of concern about that anymore, even though there had been a firestorm of protests earlier when Governor Perpich had introduced it. So in 1988, I did propose it as an amendment to the K-12 finance bill, and it just went on. There just wasn't a lot of discussion about it, and the media didn't realize it for about 4 days. And it just happened. And that's really, truly a lesson to be learned, because the attention was all over here on statewide testing. Well, when it did get to the conference committee, by that time the firestorm started and the House was concerned about it, that's when Dan stepped in and really negotiated that effort out along with the governor, and that's how mandatory open enrollment passed in the state of Minnesota. Once that occurred, there was the need then, in the view of many of us, that to finish the job. We had, through this notion of open enrollment, created access to choices. Every public school student now could have access to choices in this state. But not every student could take advantage of it, because the choices weren't always in their backyard or in their neighborhood. So even though we had access to choices, we didn't have very many different choices to access. And that was what the key that was missing. is that we didn't have different choices to access. If they were all similar choices, then what was the value of having more choice? And so at an Itasca seminar that we had in 1988, Representative Ken Nelson and I and others attended, along with a number of business leaders, community leaders, and educators. And there was discussion about this whole notion. One of the speakers, and my representatives have heard this story before, was a man by the name of Al Shanker. And he was leading the American Federation of Teachers at the time, and he talked about something called charter schools. His notion was to empower teachers. And you know what? That was what I had been hearing about as a student at St. Olaf College, that my colleagues who had graduated from St. Olaf College and were teachers were feeling that they were constrained by their districts, that they couldn't create new things, that they wanted to do some more things to encourage and impassion their students, but they couldn't. Their hands were tied. And so here was Albert Shanker saying, this is an opportunity to have autonomous schools, public school choice, and allow teachers to take the lead. And I thought that was very powerful. So three or four of us truly sat down after he spoke and several other people spoke at this seminar and created the concept of charter schools on a dinner napkin over dinner at this conference. And that's where it began. The four of us, Urban League leader, two educators, and myself, started to bounce this off of others at the forum, and then for 3 years developed it here in the Senate. It took 3 years to pass, but that too has a story in lessons to be learned. The bill that passed in charter schools finally, when it was put together, was compromised significantly. I'll never forget the evening of the conference committee where the Senate had passed the charter school bill, but the House was still resistant. At this time, they were both in Democratic hands. And I remember that when the compromises were put into the bill, that I felt so strongly that it would never work. And I left the room virtually in tears, thinking that all that work had been over. And I felt that given the compromises, that there would never be a charter school. And the decision that had to be made by those of us who were working on this bill was whether we go ahead in this very compromised fashion or start again next year. And we made the decision, a critical decision in retrospect, to go ahead and at least just get the words in the law. But the compromises were so great at that time that it required two approvals, both from the state and from the local government, instead of an alternative approval from the state. So it meant basically two approvals rather than one, and it didn't provide that leverage that we needed to make the system move. It passed in that compromise version, not easily. Only a few of you are here. It's amazing to me how much the turnover has been in the legislature. I just see a few of my own representatives. Representative Carlson, of course, is here. I remember, too, that just shortly thereafter, because those words went into the law, Senator David Durenberger took the law to Washington. And from there, I wasn't prepared for what was to happen. Senator Durenberger started talking about getting startup funding for charter schools. The Democratic Leadership Council, of which I am a very committed member, asked me to help to recruit Senator Joe Lieberman as the alternate sponsor for the Democrats. I did so. Senator Lieberman went on the bill with Senator Durenberger. We had a bipartisan bill, which is the third lesson, and that is it's very bipartisan. This issue has always been bipartisan in Minnesota, and I do not want that ever, ever, ever to change. It's so important. And Senator Durenberger, Senator Lieberman took the bill, got the approval of, as you know, Senator Clinton, President Clinton, and they went forward and really spread the whole concept of charter schools around the country. I don't have children in the public schools. And my biggest concern about the intervening years and the passage of public school choice and today, because we're kind of in the teenage years of it right now. My biggest concern is that there have been many interpretations put to why charter schools were created. I don't have children in school. I am not an educator. I'm a lawyer. The reason, truly, that motivated me as one legislator was to empower teachers. The second reason was that there's many, many students who are not getting the opportunities they need in schools. There are many girls and boys who suffer from low self-esteem. Guess what, folks? The research shows that 2/3 of girls suffer from a low self-esteem. They lose it somewhere in those school years. I'm one of those. I never had a high self-esteem. I wanted a public school that would build that self-esteem for all children and that they could find that opportunity to fit them. That's what motivated me as one legislator. In the House, everybody else maybe had different reasons, but Representative Kelso, the House author, was a school board member and saw it as an opportunity for accountability and opportunity and having a new and different voice. Senator Jen Olson, my very strong co-author in the Senate, extraordinarily helpful, was just really, really there for the kids. So all of us had different reasons, but ultimately, this, I believe, has created new opportunities for children, and that's the main result. The success of that has indeed been twofold. One is that many students have participated, and parents have been satisfied with a lot of the progress that has been made. The other thing that I think has been a great success has been, Mr. Chairman, the impact on district public schools. That's huge. We cannot discount the impact that this has had on district public schools. And that means in the sense of having more initiatives like all-day kindergarten or more initiatives like advanced placement courses or whatever, because they now need to, they have incentive, if you will, to meet those needs of the parents and the children that are not otherwise being met. The challenge charter schools now has been truly having the sponsor be responsible in that sponsoring and giving the guidance that is needed to make them work. And I'm really appreciative of former Representative Segrin's and Commissioner Segrin's move recently to strengthen that sponsor. That, I think, is the number one critical component that needs to be done to strengthen accountability in charter schools. I will also say that I think the single thing that has created problems in accountability of charter school over the years has been one of those compromises that came out of the conference committee that night back in 1991, and that was the compromise that said that teachers had to be a majority of the governing board of the school. I am now an attorney advising nonprofits. I cannot even imagine the conflict of interest this is creating. You're basically having the CEO-led team be in charge of the board. Do you realize what this has done to accountability? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And it also limits the size of the board. It limits the size of the board. So you can't have outside people coming on who have financial expertise. It limits the size because if you have a majority of teachers and there are only 3 teachers in the school, you can't have more. So that, I think, has been one of the main components of creating that lack of expertise on the board, and then that together with the lack of sponsor oversight. Proper training, I think, has contributed to the problems. And then the last thing I would just simply say, the biggest challenge, I think, is to help the public understand what charter schools really are and what they're meant to be. Challenges or opportunities for children, empowerment for teachers, an opportunity for citizens to take the lead. It's the freedom to be better. I'd like to help that effort around the country to help people to understand better why, what the original intent was. And so for that, in closing then, I do have some materials that I can pass out that I actually did write for called the Charter School Experience was with a grant from the U.S. Department of Education. I only have about 10 of these, so for the committee, for the chairman, for those who actually will have an interest in this, I know how much reading you get. If you don't get one and want one, let me know. And Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly available for questions after Mr. Grava, but I simply want to thank you for this opportunity today and your interest in moving education forward and for our kids. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator. Senator, is it my understanding that you will have to leave at around 9:30?
About 9:40 or so, yes.
Oh, okay. Good. So we'll make sure we, if we do have questions, that we can get those in before you have to leave. Mr. Grava.
Thank you, Member Love. We're delighted. We were worried that you weren't going to make it, and it's nice that you were able to be here with us. Let me recycle back to some of my opening comments and just a little bit of history. A lot of you educators will know these numbers, but folks, it's important, I think, to realize the changes we made in our expectations in the 1900s, in the 20th century. If you go back about 100 years ago, this is kind of hard to believe, but in 1900, we think that fewer than 5% of Americans had finished high school. Now, we didn't count dropouts because there simply wasn't the expectation that you would go to school in 1900. That data comes from the census, and the actual number, frankly, I think is less than 3% of our 18-year-olds had finished high school in 1900. That number kept escalating all the way through the 20th century. I started teaching in Wadena in 1961. That's 44 years ago this fall, and we think the dropout rate in Minnesota, and we've now started changing it over to counting dropout rates, was about 40%. Now, it turns out that computing dropouts is just really complex, and so the numbers were slushy, I'm sure, and almost none of the handicapped children were in our schools in 1961. That all happened in the last part of the 60s and in the 70s and into the 80s. And then in the late 80s, this country started saying that every child should learn at relatively high levels. And folks, that's the right goal. None of us should argue with that goal. But I think we really need to be frank about this and say that we've never done that. Frankly, I think it's accurate to say that no country has ever done this, folks. And I want to say to you that we in America have never come close to this achievement. I personally believe that the current education system serves no more than about 60% of its children reasonably well. Let me tip that over and say that I think of roughly 40% of the children are not well served by our current approaches to education in America. Now that's a harsh number, and it can, I don't care if you think it's 35 or if you think it's 45, the point I want to make is that we're a long ways from achieving the goal. I also want to say to you, and I think this is really important for all of us to understand, this is not just an urban problem. I personally believe that there are 2 to 3 times as many children in the suburban and rural parts of this state who are poorly served by their education systems as we find in the urban areas. That 40% is scattered all over the state. I taught in Wadena County, a rural county. I taught these kind of children. I know they're out there. The slice varies by region. In some areas it may be 15%. In other areas, it may be 60% of the children are not well served. But they're there, and to the individual child, it doesn't make any difference whether you're in a school with 40% poorly served or 5% poorly served, the impact on you is the same, and frankly, the impact on society is the same. So please, let's not assume. I have to do this in almost every one of these meetings because the tendency is for all of us to focus in on the problems in the urban areas. And I know that's serious, and it's clearly the most concentrated part of our problem, but it is not the only part of our problem, and we all need to recognize that that's the case. This country, for the last 25, 30 years, has been involved in a major struggle to try to find ways to help more of our children be successful learners. And we have spent, across this country, folks, billions and billions of dollars. I frankly think it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think it's honest to say that almost nobody is satisfied with the progress we make. I don't think anybody inside the system is satisfied, and I think almost nobody outside the system is satisfied with the progress we've made. Almost all of our effort in these last 30 years has been focused on trying to improve the schools we have. And I think that's natural. It's probably the right starting place. But folks, it's led me to comment that almost all Americans want their schools to be better, but almost nobody wants them to be different. And that's one of the major struggles that we have, in my opinion.
We have a question
for
one of our members.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I just want to get on the list for when they're done. I want to wait.
Okay. Wonderful. Continue.
We have, folks, unknowingly, I think, defined the problem as a performance problem. Actually, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody say this, but if you look back at what we've tried to do over the last 20, 25 years, we have essentially assumed that it was a performance problem. So we spent money trying to get better curriculum, and we decided that we needed better superintendents, and we have foundations that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to get us better leadership for our districts. And we've decided that principals are the key, and so we've tried to elevate the quality of our principals, and the most recent, of course, is trying to find better our teachers and ways to improve the quality of instruction. Standards-based accountability is part of the improvement process, based on the assumption that the problem is a performance problem. And I don't want to be critical of that, because clearly we need to improve in all of those categories. There's just no question about that, and I don't want to denigrate those efforts. But I do want to say to you that we have ignored the possibility that it is also a design problem. And I want to tell you today that I have come to believe that it is at least partly a design problem, and I want to speak to that from two levels. First of all, I think we need schools that are designed differently. But also I want to talk to you about changes in the system level design as well. The first conclusion I make, folks, and this is tough for an old educator, old union leader, to say that I believe that if this country is going to realize its escalated goals for public education, it needs to create schools that are fundamentally different. Not mildly different, but different in fundamental ways from the schools we used during the 20th century. Now, I don't want to scrub the schools we've got. That's not what I'm saying. But we need to create significant numbers of schools that use different approaches to helping our youngsters learn. The second assertion I want to make with you this morning, and this is really tough, is that I don't think we can get those schools by changing the schools we have. Let me say that again. I don't believe we can get those schools by changing the schools we have. We have to start those schools new in order for them to be fundamentally different from the schools we use. Now, I know that's shocking to many people, but folks, I spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and there is a lot of research out of the private sector that supports the idea that most of the fundamental change in our economy comes not from changing existing companies, but comes from the creation of brand new organizations. One of the researchers that we are now working with is a guy named Clayton Christensen out of Harvard Business School. And Clayton's research demonstrates that we have overestimated the ability of organizations to change themselves. And he goes through industry sector after industry sector and points out examples of that. I just this morning heard on the radio driving into the Capitol that AT&T is going out of business. We think that we're seeing the end of AT&T. That happens much more often than most of us realize. Another author, Richard Foster, is with the McKinsey Group. It's that large consulting group. And that McKinsey Group put together a database on the private companies, the largest private companies in America, over, I think, about 40 years, from 1968 to 96. They examined and created a database of 1,008 companies, folks. There were only 160 of them there at the beginning and at the end. The rest had fallen out of the category. If you look at the Standard & Poor's 500, created in 1957, you get exactly the same picture. Of the 500 companies in the S&P 500 in 1957, only 74 of them were still there in 1997. We walk by this, but this is constantly happening in our economy. And it is happening, folks, because these companies cannot change themselves. Now, I know there's a lot of resistance in education to using private sector research and applying it to public education. And I've agreed with that but for many years. But most of the time, it's the private sector saying, this is how we do it in private enterprise, and you ought to be able to do it the same way. This research, folks, is 180 degrees from that. This research is saying that even in the private sector, we can't change ourselves in fundamental ways. And as a result, we end up losing our companies as a result of it. This is not welcome news to business leaders. Business leaders like to give us the impression that they can change and manage their companies into the future. The history says otherwise. The research says otherwise. I've never heard anybody try to argue that public education is more adaptable than our private sector. I just don't think that's a defensible position. So this research, in my opinion, tells us a lot about what we need to do to create the kind of schools we need to expand the range of children that we serve well. Now, one of the things they talk about is culture, the culture of an organization. Foster says every organization creates a culture, and it's made up of the assumptions on which the organization was created, the processes that the organization uses to carry out its work, and the values that develop inside the organization that guide the decision of the people in the organization. He calls the culture the invisible architecture of the organization. Those of us that have tried to change schools know that they have a lot of invisible architecture. Another thing that Christensen points out is that the mainline customers are a major obstacle to changing the company. The mainline customers almost always want the existing product or service to be better, not different. Folks, I think almost everybody in this room is a mainline customer for public education. The dilemma, part of the dilemma that we face is that the leaders in our society were almost invariably well served by the schools we used during the 20th century. They served me pretty well, they served my children pretty well, and my grandkids love our schools. And yet we have huge numbers of children that aren't well served, but the decision makers at the educational system, in the political system, even our business leaders, were well served by the traditional model. And we almost invariably come down saying, let's just make it better, not different. And that's one of the real challenges I see for us as we think about changing that system. Folks, the culture gets started in the first years of a company. Foster says the culture gets started in the first years, and then the dilemma is that the world changes, and the organization can't change its culture. Now, let me go back to schools. Our education system was designed to serve about 20% of the children. In the early stages, the assumption was that no more than the first quartile, the first 25% of the children would go. The history of the 20th century is that we just kept shoving the next quartile in, and then the next quartile in, and somewhere toward the end of the century, we said everybody needs to be well served. And we never changed the system. We never assumed, we quietly bought into the idea that the system that served the first quartile would also serve the last one. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that that's a false assumption. My personal belief is that the system we designed served the first quartile of children pretty well, first 25%, served the second quartile reasonably well, served the third quartile marginally, and the fourth quartile has not been served very well at all by the current system. And so my message to you today, folks, is that we need to be open to radically different approaches to schooling. Schooling that is different in fundamental ways, and we need the opportunity to create these different ways from scratch with new cultures, new assumptions, new processes, new values. Let me tell you that what Dan, in my opinion, that what Dan and Amber were describing to you and what has happened during the ensuing years is that you really have started creating what we've begun calling the open sector of public education. A new sector of public education that is open to other people starting schools, people other than the school districts, that is open to fundamentally different approaches to structuring schools. A lot of us assume learning programs are different, and that's true in many cases. Learning programs are different. Folks, I've come to believe that the culture inside our schools is the most important feature of it, more significant than the learning program, but that's just a personal opinion. But you have started to create a policy framework for this new open sector. Let me reiterate what your chairman said at the beginning of your meeting. Education in America is a state function. I think this is accurate, that every state constitution delegates that authority to the legislatures of the 50 states. The public education system in America is the result of you folks and people before you who incrementally designed the system we currently have. About 20 years ago, you began, without recognizing it, as Dan said, to design a new form of public education with choice as one of its major characteristics.
And that is, in my opinion, leading to the creation of an open sector. We have a policy framework in our laws, in our regulations, that created the district system. We're in the process of creating a policy framework for this new sector. Post-secondary options, I think of that, folks, as vertical choice that let the juniors and seniors go up, and inter-district choice and chartering are all pieces of that open sector. All three of those originated in Minnesota. All three of those have spread across the country. I now work quite a bit around the country, and everybody looks to this legislature for leadership in educational innovation. It is a major challenge that I think that we place before you. I want to tell you that I think that there is no other issue, including terrorism, folks, that's more important to the future of this country than finding ways to help every child become a successful learner. And that means that all kinds of us have to give up on our vision on what public education can be, and needs to be willing to expand that vision to radically different approaches for children who don't do well in the current system. One of the nice approaches about, one of the nice features about choice is that you don't need to go in and change everybody else's vision. All you need to do is to create the options and let parents and children self-select, and the teachers that are frustrated with the traditional approach to self-select themselves into the new organization. I'm going to just take a minute to tell you about my favorite model for this, Mr. Chairman. 40-some years ago, at the end of the 50s, the first half of the century, department stores dominated retailing in America. And then in the 1950s, discount retailing started to appear. Clayton Christensen, one of the researchers I mentioned, says that in 1960 there were 300 department store companies in America. Only one of those department store companies made it into discount retailing. Dayton Hudson's. About 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I got into a conversation with one of the Dayton brothers, Doug Dayton. And he told us that back in about 1959, the Dayton brothers, started going to meetings and picking up feedback on discount retailing. And they came back and had lengthy discussions. He didn't say arguments, but I suspect there were arguments. And he said, we finally decided that somebody was going to create discount retailing. And so we decided to create Target. And I said, now, when you created Target, tell me, did the head of Target report to the head of the department stores? And he kind of chuckled, this was a phone interview, and said, no, I headed up Target, and I reported directly to the board. He said, my brother Ken ran the department store operation. And then he kind of chuckled again, and he said, Ken grumbled all through the 60s and 70s because I was chewing into his market share. He said, we could not believe what was happening with Target. He said, we overshot our revenue estimates year after year after year. Folks, through much of the 90s, Target opened a new store a week, to give you an indication. Now, let's go back and look at what else happened. 5 years ago, they changed the name. 4 years ago, to Target, got rid of Dayton Hudson. Last summer, they sold their department stores. Folks, Montgomery Ward's went into bankruptcy, went out of business 5 years ago. Another department store organization. Sears closed stores all through the 90s, and last summer was bought out by Kmart. None of those department store boards had the courage to create a competitor for their main line operation.
They ignored what the Dayton brothers concluded was that somebody was going to do discount retailing. And they thought they were being more loyal to their operation by staying with the original business model. I keep hoping that more districts will begin to see the need to create these new schools alongside the schools they have. The Dayton brothers were smart enough not to close their department stores. They let the two exist side by side, and the customers, over 45 years, made the decision for them. And that's the model that I think we need to use. And I want to say that you can do that at the district level, and we have some superintendents that are now beginning to look at it that way. But I would also like, Mr. Chairman, for you folks to think of yourself as the corporate board for public education in this state. And you need to create the two systems side by side and over time allow the public to decide of which schools they want to attend. I think that our current system serves most of our children reasonably well. But I don't think we can reach our escalated goals for public education if we don't have a system that facilitates constantly the creation of new schools. Minnesota is further ahead, folks, in this area with the policy framework than any state I know. And I want to thank you for that. And I want to tell you that we do need some tweaking to that policy framework. But in general, I think the policy framework is in reasonably good shape in Minnesota. Thank you, and Mr. Chairman, maybe we should go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grieba, Mr. Wartz, and Ms. Reichscott Young. I appreciate your comments. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. I appreciate your comments as well. And my question, I was beginning to think as Mr. Grieba went on, was going to be answered, but then he kind of stopped. And my question is, what do you see as, if you were serving in the legislature or working in the governor's office, would you be proposing this session, tweaking, you said, but is there's the policy framework in place. If you were looking to do something bold, would you see anything that there would be a role for the state or not, and what would that be if there would be? And then secondly, could you comment on No Child Left Behind and the federal role that we have, and if you see that as a help, a hindrance, or a neutral?
Mr. Grieba.
Okay, good, thanks. Ember alluded to one of the issues that we think, about 3 years ago, we started studying the sponsorship function in the charter sector, folks, and became convinced that nobody had thought through enough about what good sponsoring is and how to go about it. Now, we found some money, foundation money, and asked former Commissioner of Education Bob Wadle to lead a project for us. And Bob has been working with the current sponsors in Minnesota to try to improve the quality of sponsoring. And we do have some legislative suggestions for ways to improve that process of sponsoring chartered schools. Can I just take an aside, Mr. Chairman, and say that I want to tell you that one of the key ingredients of this open sector is failure. Now, I know you don't like that. It's really hard for political folks to defend failure. But one of the key ingredients in innovation requires the freedom to try things that nobody else has tried before. And so being willing to allow the creation of schools that... I walk around, one of my favorite schools is Minnesota New Country School, folks, down in Henderson. I can tell you, I never would have created that school. I mean, I'm too trapped by my old visions of what school is. I could never have created that kind of school. And we need to be open to that possibility. We also need to have the courage to close schools that aren't working. Now, one of the major frustrations for me is that we have too many of the new schools failing because of fiscal mismanagement. You know, these are educators, these are teachers, and they're parents, and they have ideas about how their kids, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're good at managing budgets and putting together what is, in essence, a small business. And so having increased infrastructure that decreases the chances for that kind of failure is my primary interest. And several of our proposals, legislative proposals, will aim in that direction.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just to add to that, Representative Greiling, regardless of your particular position on the State Board of Education, one of the roles that it had that I thought was critical for charter schools was as a sponsor for charter schools. And so if the State Board of Education is not there, then one of the things that we had talked about was having a separate entity that would charter, a state entity, a charter school board that would provide for sponsoring for charter schools. So that function was lost in that transition. There are several other areas that we've explored in charter school work, and that is in the whole area of a charter district. And I think some of you, the chairman has a bill, that chairman has a bill on charter districts, right? And so that's another area that I think is an opportunity to explore ways to just to stimulate the system.
Representative Severson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we can get to Mr. Lawrence and then the No Child Left Behind question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, the No Child Left Behind, you know, which is really just the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, if you think about it that way. There was Title I, No Child Left Behind is basically just a major Title I program. I mean, it's a massive Title I program. And so the federal issue of, you know, we should have some process that works across the country, but the standards are left to the states, I think is the biggest issue. I mean, there is no uniform standards across the state. So there are states with very low standards, hence they don't have very many schools on not making annual yearly progress, you know. And so it is something we don't have to do. However, there's some risk if we don't do it. They can't make us do it, but we got to lose a little money if we choose not to do that. But I think the whole idea that there would be idea that there would be standards, which is right, and that there would be some assessment of those standards is right. So just, I would say, you know, after working for a governor for a long time, I mean, it is, I can understand what Governor Pawlenty and his staff goes through and any other governors. So what proposal do you make? What do you say to the legislature? Because Joe is right. The legislature decides. I mean, every time I showed up at the legislature, I had some senator or house member take me aside and point in the Constitution that says the legislature shall, not the governor, not the Department of Education, not anybody else, the legislature shall. You understand that, Mr. Lawrence? Yes, I understand that. So, but anyway, the governor can, you know, doesn't have to negotiate with a lot of people, so you get to have an idea. You know, you can have an idea. Rudy, if he was still alive, and I do miss him. I wish I could talk to him. But he, as you know, he came from a background where he did not speak English. He felt that he was denied access to the quality public schools of Hibbing. And he and his brothers, you know, went on to legislative careers, school board. But Rudy was always of this issue of the idea that, as Joe said, the current public schools are serving 60% or more of the students, I think, very well. And they have to be funded and they have to be supported, and we have to find a way to do that, and we need assessments. So part of the proposal has to be, what do we do with the public schools that we have, the ones that everybody doesn't want to be different. And for a lot of folks, and they shouldn't be different. They're working very, very well. The other issue is, so what are the access questions? So Rudy pursued issues about the area learning centers were created during that time as an access, that nonprofits could receive state funds as part of a high school graduation incentives program. And so I think the policy framework that would have come If Rudy was here, he would say, I would have a series of initiatives about access in other areas. So whether I would strengthen or in some way continue to learn about the chartering process, how would we do that? But there are also other providers that could be available and are. And so how are they, how do students do that? How do they move into that? And of course, the open enrollment and the high school graduation incentives program, which was really set up to allow students who were not doing very well to seek out other providers, not just schools, not just at the time there were no charter schools, but other ones. So, Representative Greiling, I think that this is the challenge, and of course, the governor has sent a framework over that deals with the current public schools. He has sent a framework over that deals with some other opportunity issues. So it still remains. The question is, those are the two agendas.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifiers. I really do appreciate the information. This is my first year on K-12, and it really does give some enlightenment as to the history that we've gone through on in terms of education for our state. And I do believe it is one of the best in the 50 United States. I've been around the United States living in various places, and it's always been kind of a shining light. I'm curious as to, I appreciate your analogies in terms of business as well, because I do. I've been in the business sector and understand, you know, the ship that can't turn with the tide ends up sinking. And so we definitely have to pay attention to not just what our school needs are, but what are the market forces in our culture, and what are the things that are going to, recently I've had the opportunity to door knock at an individual who's a professor at one of our universities, and he talked about China and how they have a university that is has 100,000 students. 90% of those are in the biosciences, they're in the engineering and in the hard sciences. And so those are some of the world forces that we're going to be running up against. And how do we adjust our educational institution to be competitive on a world market? Raises some serious questions. And I'm just curious on two points. One would be your comments on the voucher. If you're talking about choice, what is your perception of the voucher system? And the second is, what do you view as the success of mainstreaming in our educational institutions?
I'm not sure that I agree. The last question I didn't track. Mainstreaming special our handicapped children and special ed.
Mr. Chair, yes, please.
Let me do the first one. Let me say that in a lot of respects, Minnesota does in fact have a voucher. It's a term that's loaded, and a lot of folks dislike the term. But students, to the extent that we define a voucher as the money following the students, under post-secondary options, the money followed the students to buy tuition and to buy books and even some transportation. Under inter-district choice, the students go across the district line to another district, the money follows the students and goes there. And the same is true with the money going into chartered schools. What we didn't do and haven't done is have not let the money follow students into religious schools or into other private schools that haven't been chartered by the state. And I frankly am comfortable at this stage in my mind with the portability of money under the public sector options. And so I haven't made that step over to being supportive of the full-blown voucher, but I do think that our Minnesota's model, folks, for letting the money follow the children into the public sector choices is an appropriate one. On the mainstreaming issue, folks, I've been away from that topic for so long that I'm not sure my opinions account for very much. I was here in the legislature when most of that legislation was being enacted, and I supported the mainstreaming of special ed children at that time. Maybe Amber or Dan would be better able to respond to whether after 30 years, looking back, that's the same, I would feel the same way. I honestly am not comfortable telling you. One of the worst things is to have old has-beens come in and try tell you based on data that's 30 years old on what you ought to do, and I am hesitant to try to do that on that topic. I just don't think I'm able. Dan, do you have a firm input?
No, I think that, time will tell whether this is the right thing to do or not, and we're in it. You know, we're in this, and the federal law passed in 1975, and of course there's been a number of changes and things that have been made, and this is back to the mainstream issue. It works for some students, it doesn't work for other students, but that is the case for everything. I mean, it works for some and it doesn't work for others. But I think we just don't know, can't call it yet. In terms of your first question, which was the voucher. I would agree with Joel. We have vouchers everywhere. I mean, Hennepin County runs the largest daycare system in the state, and it has no daycare system that it has. It's all voucher. The entire thing is voucher. So post-secondary enrollment options is a voucher. Charter schools is a voucher. Open enrollment was a voucher. High school graduation incentive programs were a voucher. The state grant program for higher ed is a voucher. So it just depends. I mean, the difference, I think, here is you actually hand the person the money. In some ways, the state grant program, you know, you get handed the money, but you have certain places where you can redeem it, only certain places where you can redeem it.
I will speak to that part. I am, you know, language is so important in politics, and so I just want to say that the charter schools really are not a voucher in what is known as the political or the traditional sense, and I really do want to clarify that for the record. I think that what you're saying is that it is, you know, similar in some principles. But I will just say that one of the concerns that really faced us in 1991 was that this was going to open the door to private school vouchers. I have not been a supporter of private school vouchers. It never did that. And I want to make that very clear. It is a separate entity. And one of the concerns that I do have is that proponents of various other agendas for education sometimes try to latch on to charters to make it sound like they were part of that particular thing, whether from the left or the right. And so I just really want, and that's why I stepped in here, because I want to make very clear that charter schools are charter schools and they are different than all of those other things. And I will just close, Mr. Chairman, since I do need to leave, with just reiterating two things. Again, the principles behind charter schools, public school choice in Minnesota, is truly what you were saying in your target example. In a sense, I said before, let citizens take the lead. Let the customers take the lead. That's what you were saying. Let the citizens take the lead here. Let their ideas, their new ideas, their opportunities be out there and generate passion in others. Allow the freedom to be better. That's what charter schools are, the freedom to be better. That's what you'll see in here. And finally, I'll close with my favorite story, which is a letter I received from a charter school student. She's a sixth grader, and she said, Senator Reichstadt, I know there's a governor and a lieutenant governor and an attorney general and a state auditor, and then next on down are the legislators. But please, could you tell me just as soon as possible, is there anything lower than a legislator? So, on that note, I say again, I thank you for your public service. Sometimes it's hard, isn't it? And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify. It truly has been a privilege, and I wish you well in the session.
Thank you very much, Senator. We appreciate having you here today. Representative Severson, you had a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up in terms of the voucher issue. I guess, you know, the things that we've talked about today are choices in a public school setting, in a setting where variables really do play to the fringes or the varying needs of our constituents or our constituents' children. And but what we're really saying is, as long as those constraints are within the current structured system, and I believe that until we get outside the current structured system, we don't understand what the possibilities are. And so I think, you know, we're trying to reform the board here by saying this is acceptable within these parameters, and nothing outside that is going to be considered. And that's why I think the voucher system offers some opportunities, maybe failures, as you talked about. But let's explore those. Let's create those as failures for reform. true reform, not reform that fits into a union contract or things that fit into something that we have always used as the drivers in the past, but some out-of-the-box thinking. So that's just my thoughts, and I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Ward.
Just a follow-up on that. In terms of the state grant program for higher education, I mean, the idea that private schools are eligible, those kinds of things, I see as kind of outside of that. The tuition tax deduction and the tuition credit are a voucher. And as Joe said, Minnesota's led the way in a lot of areas. We had the first tuition tax deduction, and we had the first tuition tax credit for private schools. And so, Ember's very nervous about that, I understand that, in terms of the word voucher. But voucher, you know, there are different types of vouchers. And so the whole idea of tax deductions, tax credits are vouchers. And we do have quite a bit that goes outside of the current system. I mean, Representative Mariani could probably talk about the kind of all of the nonprofits and areas that provide services to students that are not part of the chartering sector or the public school sector. So I do think we're further along than it might appear on that continuum.
Representative Sikora.
Oh. Sorry, my question was really answered by somebody else's question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that it was acceptable for a charter school to have fiscal problems and fail. That's acceptable despite the fact that it impacts students and teachers. I had a student who I taught at the middle state who's supposed to be in the biggest failure lost $2,000. My question then is, if that's acceptable, how do you explain the new studies that are coming out that students in charter schools perform at a dramatically lower level than students in traditional schools? Is that acceptable, Mr. Graber?
Mr. Graber.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, I think there have been a lot of disagreement about the studies that have come out with that assertion. But let me tell you that one of the findings from the private sector research, Mr. Chairman, is that almost always the new organizations that are getting started are viewed as lower in quality in the first few years. And I don't think we should be surprised at research, even if it is accurate, that indicates that charters are not yet equal to the traditional operation in the average. But I also want to tell you that I think the research, and folks, we really need a lot of research. Charters are not a kind of school. Chartering is a process for creating schools, and it's a charter is a legal shell that lets somebody create a school, and what goes inside the school varies radically. I think that there's just no question but what we have chartered schools that aren't performing as well as they ought to perform. I mean, I just don't have any question about that, and I think they ought to be closed. I'm being open to that. I want to tell you, though, that we've got a lot of public district schools that fit that description, and nobody closes them. And the system doesn't contemplate that those schools would be closed, except now, to some extent, under No Child Left Behind. So, but folks, what we need, and I keep saying this, we keep saying this to the research community in the country, we need extensive research on the kinds of schools that are being created. Which models are working for which kinds of children? And then we need an effort to replicate those models. But until we get good research on which models are working, it is difficult to convince people that they ought to be replicated. And that's really a key, I think, is finding out which models. My hope is that we'll continue to experiment with alternative approaches, I'm sure we'll find that some models work for some kinds of children and not for other kinds of children. We need to then demonstrate whether or not they work, and then we need to find ways to replicate the successful models. Some of that is going on. The Gates Foundation does, in fact, give significant grants for replicating certain models that they believe are high-quality schools. And as that occurs over time, and as we get better at making the hard decisions about closing ineffective schools, I think we'll see the quality of those schools, of the average, come up. And that's obviously the long-term goal.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you. You really didn't answer the question, but I appreciate the fact that at some point they did. My next question is, you mentioned post-secondary options and charter schools as successes. Can you tell me what states emulated the graduation rule and the profile of learning states that learned with for 10 years and spent a quarter of $1 billion on? Can you tell me if that was a success at any stage?
Mr. Graber.
No, I don't. I haven't done any national research on either the graduation. Well, let me tell you that there are lots of graduation rules across the country. I don't know to what extent they would compare to what Minnesota's was at all. I winter in Arizona, folks, and I just came back up the day before yesterday, and Arizona has been wrestling with their AIMS test for, I'd say, 5 or 6 years, and they're trying to figure out how to establish exit exams is a really difficult task, and so I have not done any research on whether or not the other states have replicated either of those.
Representative Pawlowski.
No, I don't think I should try to do that. I haven't done any. I don't think that fits into the open sector at all. All of those were efforts to improve the existing system, I think.
Who's chairing it?
Yes, I'm chairing it. Go ahead.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Representative Pawlowski, you know, the discussion here is about our desire to have children learn. And I think we need to remember that that this is a challenge of monumental proportions for some children. Children from age 5 to 18 spend 12% of their life in school. They spend 88% of their life outside of school. Now, they sleep 30% of the time, we hope. But it's still 5 to 1. 5 to 1. And children who come to the school door pretty well prepared do pretty well. They do pretty well. Students who come to the school door not well prepared or having early life experiences that are difficult, who start behind. There are schools... There are no schools that are having success with some of those children just because it is just such a difficult situation. Plus, once they get them, they still only have them a small amount of the time. So, you know, when I taught in Moundsview, there was a question about whether I was responsible for what the children learned in my class, and I said I was responsible for 12% of it. That did not go over very well. But I think that we hold schools and teachers responsible for a lot, and they do very well given students who come with positive experiences. But we are still challenged whether they're the current schools, the districted schools, the chartered schools, whether we have standards or whatever. I mean, it is an issue about if you went to the doctor and the doctor gave you a test and says you have this disease. He said, do you have any cure for this disease? And the doctor says, no, but why don't you come back in 6 months, we'll test you again. And you come back in 6 months and they test you, say, you know, you still have that disease. I said, well, do you have anything that will fix that? No. Why don't you come back, we'll test you again. And it just goes on. It is a difficulty that testing has surfaced challenges in the way we go about trying to provide, deliver instructional services for children. And what Joe was talking about is, and I agree, that we need more options. That the current system is just not capable But there are many chartered schools that are created that are not capable either. So, I don't know. That's too long. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, could I just make a quick comment? It's kind of long. As I look across the country, I think we are on sort of a dual track on series of actions about education. One of them I call the standards-based accountability system, where we are putting in place standards, evaluating the process of children reaching those, or the success rate, and then the consequences, those three pieces of that effort. And on the other side is this open sector effort. And folks, that is really growing around the country. I see, just take the Mayor Daley in Chicago deciding that he wants to create 100 new schools. The Chancellor in New York City wanting to create 100 new schools, mostly through the chartering process. In Miami, in Los Angeles, in Buffalo, all of those examples are there. And so that part is kind of alongside. I think we should say to ourselves and to everybody that all of this is a learning process, Mr. Chairman. We're all trying to learn about how to structure these. That's true with the open sector. It's true, I think, with the standards-based approach to accountability. And as time goes on, frankly, I think we need both. I think we need standards. I grew up as a teacher in a time when, as Dan would say, we were in the opportunity business. We offered courses. We hoped kids learned. But if they didn't, nobody knew, because we didn't test. We had no real expectations on a statewide basis. I think that needs to change, and that's why I think that we do need state-level expectations for learning. But I also think we need to say to ourselves that this is a work in progress on both of these two approaches to education improvement.
And Mr. Chairman, just a footnote to that. You know, we talk about the achievement gap, but there are many gaps. We have an achievement gap, we have a parental education gap, we have a health care gap, we have an income gap. I mean, there are gaps. I mean, there are gaps all over the place. And so to try to kind of settle out the achievement side of this thing is very difficult without some other things happening. So,
Representative Norness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was actually asked, but if I could make a comment, I'd just like to say that I've enjoyed the kind of historic, you know, review here. That I served on the school board for a number of those years during some of those changes, and I also think back to I'm from Otter Tail County, and I think we were one of the last counties to close our country schools. Happened in the late 60s, and both of my parents and my in-laws were graduates of country schools, and but, you know, thinking back to that particular time, those folks graduating even from the eighth grade really were grounded in the basics. And they had enough tools to go on and be successful farmers and businessmen and contractors, and did a lot to build the state to, you know. So we enjoy a lot of what they accomplished. So it appears to me as we're still evolving. You know, the system is still moving forward, trying to find perfection, and maybe one day we'll get there.
I think, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, Representative Norman, if you take the children who attended those schools, you know, they're still only in school, 12% of the time, but the support for them outside of school was enormous, you know, in terms of that. And probably when they arrived at school, the support they had before they arrived was enormous. And that's a challenge that we have. There are just too many children who don't have the kind of support necessary before they arrive at school. And we have still too many children who don't have the support necessary while they're in school. And but those schools worked because everything worked. Everything worked. So,
thank you. Representative Thorne. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I also appreciated the discussion and have lots of questions, and I wish we had more time to follow up. My general observation is that sometimes I'm surprised that our schools do as well as they do, that it is a grand experiment to take all those different kids and put them into groups and say that they will progress as a group. As a writing teacher, I tell my students, I've never heard of a piano teacher who tries to do what I do, to put 25 kids in the room with pianos at the same time and say, I'm going to teach you all how to play the piano. I even wonder if perhaps we're even more successful, and that's one of the questions I've got, than even the 60%, and I'm wondering if you have some data that would pin down sort of where you're getting that 40% number. When I just think of the number of people who are mainline customers currently, who continue to use the status quo with some satisfaction, I'm guessing it might be even higher. But so one of my questions at some point is, can you, if not today, show me where you're getting that from. But secondly, we haven't talked a lot about the characteristics of those who don't. We've kind of gotten to it in terms of those who aren't prepared at the beginning. Are they the ones who aren't satisfied or working, or are we dealing with kind of the realities of the bell curve view of the world, where those who want to go faster aren't very happy and those who can't keep up aren't very happy, or is it a broader range of characteristics of those whom we're not serving as well as we wish, whatever the percentage is? So
well, Mr. Graber.
Well, there's just no question. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with. I have to say that I sometimes think that our system works better than we deserve, and because we really have a rigid system, and it is. And so I make my comments not in an attempt to be critical, but in an attempt to be honest about what I think is the potential for meeting what I think is the rest of the 40%, John. And and that's not a scientific number for me, John. And I don't care as I said, I don't care if you think it's 35 or 30. But let me just tell you that I pick it up from a variety of areas. Number one is that the dropout rate nationwide is somewhere in the middle 20s. Depending on the computation that's used. And my personal belief is that there is an in-school dropout rate that nobody tries to calculate. And these are simply kids that the parents won't let quit coming, but they're there. And when I was teaching, that number, I think, was at least 25% of the kids were in that category. That's maybe decreased at this point, but I think it's in the neighborhood. And frankly, I have used that number all over the country. I get challenged on the other side more often, John. I have to be honest and tell you that one of our natural assumptions is to think that I'm talking only about the kids that don't do well by our tests. And I want to tell you that I think there are kids who get respectable grades who are not well served by the current system and whose potential is literally stifled by the lockstep process, the batch processing approach that we use. And so I think that it's inevitable that we're going to see this market fragment like all other markets are fragmenting. And I think of public education and the dollars that the taxpayers spend as creating kind of a unique market, but a market. Let me just quickly remind you, folks, 25 years ago in 1980, this country had about 5 TV networks. And they provided our sports, they provided our weather, they provided our movies, they provided our news, they provided our entertainment. That market has fragmented in ways that none of us could have predicted in 1980. 35 years ago, this country had about 5 major magazines. Look, Life, Newsweek, U.S. News, Time, walk into any newsstand at the airport or in a drugstore and look at what happened to that market. The same is true in automobiles. Markets are fragmenting, and I think that if public education doesn't find a way to meet the desire for diversity in approaches to learning, we're going to lose public education in this country. And I don't want to see us do that. I personally believe that public education is one of the major reasons this country reached the level of success that it reached in the 20th century. But I also believe that we can't use the same system to meet our escalated needs in the new century that we used in the 20th century. And that means that some of us have to have the courage to step outside and try to find ways to diversify the public education system so that we can meet what I think are the appropriate escalated expectations.
Members, Mr. Grabe and Mr. Lawrence, thank you so much for spending time with us today. The purpose of today was to provide a platform to start thinking about this whole system and the system that we've created, and to have conversations with people who have thought about it and who have actually acted on working through that system, and I hope you found that fruitful. As a reminder, members, on Tuesday we are going to Waseca to visit on the TAP program. The buses will be leaving from the front of the state office building on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The buses will leave at precisely 8 o'clock. We will start loading the buses at 7:45. And so look to see you there. With nothing else on the docket, this meeting stands adjourned.